While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia, make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On The Radio News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station. Now, of course, today is a Friday, the 8th of May, 2026, and as the country continues to respond to changing economic realities, governance priorities, and social developments, we once again focus on the stories driving national conversation and public interest. Now, this afternoon on the radio, we unpack the developments that matter most, from government policy and economic performance to education, infrastructure, youth empowerment, governance, and the day-to-day realities affecting communities across Namibia. Now, as always, we go beyond the headlines to ask the important questions on what is influencing the decisions being made today and how those developments affect ordinary Namibians and what do they mean for the future of the country. Now, right here on the Reader, we believe informed citizens build stronger societies. That is why we do more than simply report the news. We provide context, encourage critical thinking, and create a space for meaningful national dialogue. Every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring you expert insight, informed analysis, and archived sound and your voice in the discussion. Because in a fast-moving world flooded with information, understanding remains essential. You can listen to us via our Eagle FM app or download the Eagle FM app, listen to us via the Eagle FM website, or listen to us via Eagle FM frequencies. Also, do stay connected through WhatsApp channel for updates, discussions, and exclusive content. So wherever you are this afternoon, at work, on the road, at home, or listening from abroad, thank you for choosing Eagle FM. Now let's get right into today's news analysis. Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture, Sanet Steenkamp, today delivered the keynote address at Namibia's commemoration of World Press Freedom Day 2026 and the celebration of the 55th anniversary of the historic Windhoek Declaration on promoting an independent and pluralistic African press. The event, held at the National Library and Archives of Namibia, also marked the inscription of the Windhoek Declaration on UNESCO's Memory of the World Registrar. In her address, Steenkamp described the inscription as another historic recognition of freedom of expression, independent journalism, and democratic governance as part of humanity's shared heritage. She said the recognition reaffirms the enduring importance of a free and pluralistic press in strengthening democracy and safeguarding fundamental rights. Let's now listen to what she had to say.
And the media advocates who gathered in Windhoek in 1991 to advance the cause of independent journalism. And esteemed ladies and gentlemen, members of the media, as we gather again once more today under the UNESCO banner, may we recommit ourselves to fostering environments within our country and also beyond, as other countries, where the media will be allowed to operate freely, with ethical and responsible reporting equally being prioritized, and defending the truth at all costs. Truth is supreme, and truth must be told at all cost. It is just right, ladies and gentlemen, that I take a moment to recognize the very courage and dedication of the journalists, past and present, including the pioneers here present today, such as Ms. Gwen Lister, who were instrumental in the development of the Windhoek Declaration and whose work helped to shape Namibia's media landscape, giving practical meaning to the ideals enshrined in the Declaration. Their contribution is now formally preserved as part of the world's documentary heritage for future generations. Today, I wish to pay special tribute. I think we can do a better omake. Ahage omake. Omake omake. Today, I wish to pay special tribute to Ms. Gwen Lister, whose courage, principled journalism, and her resolve to speak truth to power helped to shape the spirit of this declaration. At a time when speaking truth came at a great personal cost, she and many others chose bravery over silence. We salute you. You reflected a few moments ago, Ms. Lister, how you were still running around with paying salaries, the difficulties that you faced, not just yourself and so many others, you know, speaking up during times when it was intolerable, when it was not allowed, when voices were not appreciated, when agency were not valued, and yet it was done. So Namibia and indeed the world, we owe gratitude to journalists who continue to serve the public and their countries with integrity, often under the most difficult and dangerous circumstances. Toivo made reference to the Congolese journalists. The EU ambassador made reference to more than 60 journalists who paid with their lives. And Ms. Gwen Lister made reference to the 300 journalists that lost their lives in Palestine alone. Ladies and gentlemen, one life lost is one life too many. It's not about the statistics. It's about the principle of every person who must have that human right. Nobody must lose their life because they have passion and perseverance to do what is right, to perform their job to the best of their abilities. So we stand in solidarity with all journalists who, as Ms. Eunice Smith said, persistently have to guard against the threat to their safety. I also wish to honor, and when I say I, it's government. Government wish to honor all journalists, all editors, photographers, broadcasters, and all storytellers. Do you know that there's a storyteller in all of us? We wish to recognize all storytellers, all those who continuously ask the most difficult and unpopular questions. The questions that makes you sit in discomfort in a chair. Thank you for doing that. With that, you elevate and you capture not just the failures that we sometimes bring forward, but also the hopes and the aspirations and the triumphs of us in a country. And thank you for keeping us in society and government accountable. May you never lose sight of speaking truth to power. May us in any key position, in the executive, in legislature, in the judiciary, may we always strive to keep the faith and keep the oath that we give to serve our country with the required integrity. And that means responding to the most difficult of questions in the most controversial of times. And may you hold us to account. Equally, we wish to state that a nation without press and media freedom runs the danger of losing its memory, its direction, and its conscience. And in Namibia, we are not prepared to lose our conscience, not locally, not on the African continent, and not on a global stage. This Windhoek Declaration, this landmark African achievement, serves as a lasting global symbol. And I just talked about the indispensable role of journalism, of freedom of expression, and democratic memory in advancing the human dignity across the globe and accountability. The issue is accountability. It's not just about the response, our esteemed editor. It's about the quality of the response. It's about the depth of the response to the people, because the people have the right to know. I really wish to say, I think there's no ministry that is not prepared to answer. I have always said since the time when I was an executive director that answer the questions. Let me see. Let there be depth. Let there be truth. Let there be statistics. Because in a time when disinformation and misinformation is so rife, we have to step up and provide the much necessary information and not sleep on the assignment. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe sometimes we don't understand the urgency. Sometimes I'm asked a question. It's posed to me and not to the PRO. The question is posed to me. I'm not with my phone. The question was asked 3 minutes past 11. I'm not with my phone because I don't enter meetings with my phone. I get that message few minutes past 6 in the afternoon. I try to respond, but it's too late. So what we are asking is also follow the channels. And I know our PROs should step up to respond and to reach out to the various directorate divisions and departments to get the correct information. And I think that's a pledge I want to make again today, that as a government, we will respond. As a ministry of Maysak, Maythakathaka in Oshiherero, we will respond. I can give you that pledge. So, let me not digress any further. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to appreciate the team that worked so hard.
How different people we gathered on this particular event. Speaking also at this commemoration is Toivo Njebela, Editor-in-Chief of Namibian Sun and also Chairperson of the Editors Forum of Namibia. Let's take a listen to what he had to contribute. And indeed, what the president also speaks there, it becomes sometimes frustrating when you want the right answers and you need to get them from the right people. Some PROs take very long to respond and some don't even respond at all. So that's where also misinformation comes in and people begin to speculate because there's no right information. So I think that pledge, we will definitely look into how fast things are going to be implemented. Nonetheless, let's take a listen to Toivo Njebela.
We are having awards coming up in early June, the Journalism Awards organized by the EFN, the Editors Forum. And we are also saying this will be the last time that the journalists from non-EFN member houses will be allowed to participate in those awards, because if you're not willing to subject yourself to the processes of accountability, but when these processes of awards and some prize money to be won, then you put up your hand. We think it's a bit unfair. So this is the last time we are allowing that. Going forward, we will only allow people who are able to subject themselves to that accountability process by being members of the EFN. Or if we now say, look, you don't have to be a member of the EFN, but we have changed that provision that says even non-members must appear before Dr. Shivameka there and account. In conclusion, really, there is a Congolese journalist who said, of course, he was commenting about the situation in Eastern DRC at the moment. I mean, and of course, elsewhere where there are a lot of troubles, where he said that taking out a camera is as dangerous as taking out a gun in some of those countries. So our thoughts are with those. We are in complete solidarity with our fellow journalists who do not have the privilege of working in an environment like the one we have in Namibia. So we don't take, again, for granted the freedoms that we have here because others do not have the privilege of just really doing their job without being shot or thrown in jail for merely asking a question to a leader or stuff like that. So we must, in conclusion, really, we must strive as an industry. I mean, to the journalists in the room, when the president spoke in her Press Freedom Day message, while she was talking about upholding or reaffirming the government's commitment towards upholding press freedom, she also made a very cardinal call to us to say that we must also come to the party. We must do our work ethically. We must do our work objectively. We must report what is true. And the message of the president coincides completely. It aligns completely with what we editors in the newsrooms are calling our journalists to do, including ourselves, of course. So ethical journalism is what we want to do ourselves. Reporting facts as they are is what we want to do ourselves. So it's not like the president is instructing us and telling us something that is alien to us. Her message completely aligns with our own aspirations. So let's heed that call. It's a difficult time with all the fake news and deep fakes and all these kind of things. And we must distinguish ourselves from those naughty boys who do those things. We are professionals, we are mainstream, and we must show that we are nothing like what we see on those platforms. Thank you very much.
Shows that the news transparent not only a human right, but the con.
Another speaker is the head of office at UNESCO, representative to Namibia, that is Ms. Eunice Smith. Let's hear what she also had to contribute.
Not only a human right, but the cornerstone of democratic societies, sustainable development, and necessary for lasting peace. This year's World Press Freedom Day global theme, which is on the banners, Shaping a Future at Peace, calls on us to reflect on the essential role of journalism in building societies that are informed, resilient, and united. In a world which is increasingly shaped by conflict, misinformation, and rapid technological change, the value of credible, independent journalism has never been greater. Where journalism thrives, and I think Gwen Lister also said so, societies are better equipped to prevent conflict, strengthen accountability, and foster trust. Where it is weakened, the consequences are profound. Polarization deepens, misinformation spreads, and democratic institutions are undermined. According to UNESCO's Global Trends report, freedom of expression has declined significantly over the past decade, with rising pressure on media, increasing self-censorship, and persistent threats to journalists' safety. At the same time, and as we have heard from Ambassador Martins, digital transformation and artificial intelligence are reshaping information ecosystems at an unprecedented pace, bringing both opportunities and risks for media independence, information integrity, and undermining public trust. It is within this global context that Namibia continues to stand out as a beacon of press freedom. As reported, and as has been said by other speakers, Namibia proudly ranks second in Africa and 23rd globally for press freedom. This achievement stands as a testament not only to strong legal protections, but also to a sustained national commitment to democratic values, transparency, and the rule of law. However, this recognition carries responsibilities. It cannot be taken for granted. It calls on all of us, including government, media houses, civil society, development partners, and citizens, to safeguard and further strengthen this space for free expression. Namibia's leadership in press freedom is deeply rooted in history. We just heard from Gwen Lister, who walked through the entire process of what happened in 1991, when African journalists adopted the Windhoek Declaration, which at the time they were not thinking about it, but has now become a landmark document which affirms the principles of a free, independent, and pluralistic media. The Windhoek Declaration not only shaped the media landscape across Africa, but around the world, and has led to the establishment, or the declaration, by the United Nations General Assembly in 1993, I think it was, of World Press Freedom Day, which we're celebrating today. In 2021, UNESCO, in partnership with the government of Namibia, once again brought together the international community here in Windhoek for World Press Freedom Day Global Conference to mark 30 years since the original Windhoek Declaration. During that conference, the Windhoek Plus 30 Declaration on Information as a Public Good was adopted, reaffirming its essential role in empowering citizens, strengthening democratic governance, and advancing sustainable development. This is particularly critical in today's digital age, where information ecosystems are increasingly shaped by algorithms, artificial intelligence, and digital platforms. Today, we celebrate the new milestone in Namibia's history, the inscription of the Windhoek Declaration into UNESCO's Memory of the World Register. This recognition affirms the global significance and ensures that the principles of the Declaration will be preserved for future generations. We are especially proud that this historic document will not only be officially handed over to the National Archives, where it will be safeguarded as a part of the nation's documentary history. This is more than just a symbolic act. It is a reaffirmation of Namibia's role at the heart of the global press freedom movement, and a reminder that the principles of free, independent, and pluralistic press, which was established in Windhoek, continues to guide us today. Building on this legacy, which began here in 1991, UNESCO continues to work closely with national stakeholders to strengthen media freedom and access to information in the country. Key milestones, such as the adoption of the Access to Information Act 8 of 2022, which enhances transparency and supports investigative journalism, was one of those areas in which UNESCO supports. We are also, and as mentioned by Madam Director of Ceremonies, we also warmly welcome Cabinet's approval in principle of the media, the community media policy for 2026 to 2030 and the information plan. On behalf of UNESCO, Madam Minister, we would like to congratulate the ministry, the government of the Republic of Namibia on taking this step. And we would also like to congratulate the Ministry of Information and Communication Technologies for their work on this important achievement.
And with that, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We won't be too long. We'll be back with more news. Stay tuned.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the I. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the I.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
The Namibia University of Science and Technology today hosted its May 2026 graduation ceremony in Windhoek, that being day two, where hundreds of students were awarded close to 3,000 were awarded qualifications across various academic disciplines. Now, the ceremony brought together graduates, families, university leadership, government officials, and invited guests to celebrate academic achievement and the contribution of higher education to Namibia's national development goals. President Ntumbonandi Ndaitwah addressed the ceremony where she congratulated graduates on their achievements and encouraged them to use their knowledge and skills to contribute meaningfully to the country's economic growth, innovation, and social progress. And she speaks about skills gap, where Namibia bridges that skill gap or fills that skills gap, and every Namibian can contribute meaningfully. Now, in her remarks, President Ntumbonandi Ndaitwah emphasized the importance of education, research and entrepreneurship in addressing national challenges, particularly youth unemployment and economic transformation. She also called on graduates to uphold integrity, professionalism and spirit of service as they enter the workforce and wider society. Now, the university leadership described the graduation ceremony as an important milestone for both the institution and the graduates, reaffirming NAST's commitment to producing skilled professionals equipped to meet the demands of rapidly evolving economy. Now, the May graduation ceremonies continues this week with graduates from different faculties receiving certificates, diplomas, degrees and PhDs in fields ranging from engineering and information technology to business, health sciences and natural resources. And for now, let's take a listen to the president's speech at the May convocation.
Of the Namibian University of Science, at the onset, I would like to thank Professor Peter Kachavivi, Chancellor of the Namibian University of Science and Technology and former Speaker of the National Assembly, for inviting me to witness and address the graduation ceremony today. I commend the leadership, council and Senate management staff and the entire NAST communities for your continuous dedication to academic excellence and national development. We recognize and appreciate your contribution to shaping Namibia's human capital. Human capital, very fundamental for any countries that is yearning to ensure prosperity for all. NAST's journey deserves special recognition. From its origins as a polytechnic institution to its transformation into full-fledged university and now into a globally recognized institution of science and technology, this progress is both remarkable and inspiring. We are informed that the number of international students who are going to be graduating today, and of course, I believe others are still part of the students at NAST. I congratulate you, NAST staff. Today, we confer various qualifications upon the class of 2025, which will contribute to the advancement of our nation. As I look upon the faces of graduates, I see a mixed emotion of excitement, achievement, and anticipation as you conclude your academic journey and a step into your professional careers. But also remember, education does not come to an end. It's long life, career, or exercise for anyone ready to discover yourself fully. Director of Ceremonies, education remains the cornerstone and foundation upon which Namibia's national development agenda is built. Our government has consistently allocated the largest share of the national budget to education, making it a priority sector each financial year. To continue investing in education, the 2025-2030 Swap Party Election Manifesto, which is translated into NDP-6, has prioritized quality education and training as one of the 7 key priority sectors. I underline quality education and training because currently we have reached at least 98-99% entry into our education. But what we have to focus on now is on quality. It does not help us to have our people having papers, but they cannot serve the nation in accordance to the papers that they are having. Hence, we talk about quality education and training. This reflects our commitment to unlock human potential, driving economic growth, and cultivating a society rooted in knowledge, equity, and opportunities. That is to say, a knowledge-based society is a productive society, and we need to be productive if we can achieve a shared, balanced prosperity in our country. I commend NAST for playing an important role in our national development agenda. Since its establishment, it has provided applied teaching, learning and research for Namibians and the world. The university offers critical, unique studies programs such as emergency medical care and medical laboratory practitioners. Its programming has, I'm happy, I think, you see, this, I was told the majority of those who are going to have doctorates are in the medicine field. That really made me so happy. As you know, it's one of my focus. It's one of my commitments to ensure that every Namibians must have access to quality health service, both in the private and the public sector. When it comes to health, there should be no second-class citizens, because all of us, we need to be healthy in order to be productive. Since its upgrading to university in 2015, NAST has grown not only in academic programs, qualification and repetition, but also in infrastructure development, thus making it possible to admit more students. In this May graduation, I'm pleased to learn that the university is graduating 163 master's degree candidates, comprising of 55 males and 108 females, and 13 doctorate degrees candidates, comprising of 4 males and 9 females. The acting vice chancellor has underlined this. In total, I am informed, 2,990 graduates are being conferred across disciplines, comprising of 1,152 males and 1,729 females. And this includes international students. Director of Ceremonies, these figures are not merely statistics. They reflect the lives transformed, families uplifted, and nations that continue to advance in knowledge, inclusion, and opportunity. I'm happy to see these figures as a person, because it is telling me I have been effective as a woman activist. And an advocate for women empowerment. But also, I'm advocate for equality between men and women. Therefore, I'm disturbed. It is really, really disturbing that these figures do not reflect the female-to-male population ratio of 51.2% and 48.8% respectively. The message is very clear to all of us. We must take the issue of the boy child very serious. If we are to strengthen our social favor and economic advancement. This trend, we have seen it coming. We have seen it coming, and I recall, as a Minister of Women Affairs and Child Welfare, I had asked the University of Namibia to make a study and to tell us what is happening, that the boy child is not moving at the same level as the girl child. Maybe this is a blessing in disguise that for the first time in this country, we have a first gentleman. God is great. Maybe he prepared this for us in order for us to respond to the challenge we are facing as a nation as far as a boy child is concerned. In the words of our Namibian first gentleman, when he was addressing the forum of the Africa First Spouses in Addis Ababa, he had this to say, and I quote, "While empowering the girl child, the boy child we neglect is the future husband of that girl." End of the quote. This is a very strong statement, and it's real. And if we analyze it, because our constitution, the Constitution of the Republic of Namibia says, the family is the basic unit of our society. And if the basic unit is weak, the society is going to be weak. Now, if you, and who forms a family in the Namibian constitution is very clear. It's a man and woman of mature age who should form a family, which is the basic, which is the basic unit of our society. And now, if you have one empowered and the other one unempowered, and historically, the unpowered is the one the society has given the power, there is going to be a crisis. And our society is going to be weak. So that's why all of us, we must take it as our responsibility to empower the boy child and support the programs of the first gentleman, which is focusing on empowering the boy child.
What profound words President Etumbona Ndindaitwah really spoke thee. We've come to realize that we, and men are speaking out. The boy child is speaking out on how we tend to uplift and empower the girl child over at the expense of the boy child. And truly, while we are empowering the girl child, the boy child we neglect is the future husband of that girl child. And really, when we empower the girl child to become a medical doctor and neglect the boy child, and majority of them become security officers and become all this and this, the security guards and this and that and that, and all those low-paying jobs, we're creating a crisis within the home. So we can't try to uplift our economy and neglect our social status, because at the end of the day, we need to go back to the definition of family in the Namibian constitution, which by it's defined as the fundamental unit, where it is the fundamental unit of a society. So building a society, we can't neglect the family aspect. And when it comes to the girl child is empowered and the boy child is not, then we'll have an issue where the girl child will be dominating, which ought not just to be the case. We need to balance it out in this within the society. And looking at President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, I think this is a practical classic example of our time. She's thriving in an era as the girl child who is Namibia's first female president. But a spouse, but a reigning president needs a spouse, a supportive spouse for that matter. And we see how the first gentleman goes with her to different missions and different places, and had him being a lieutenant general, having been a lieutenant general, that just comes also with the security measures that also come with him, you know, being by her side and being an aide and a supportive guide. So really, it's a conversation that needs thorough contribution from all walks of life, so that we do not neglect the boy child. You know, you don't want to have a situation or a home where the girl child is equipped and trained and thriving, but the boy child is neglected. And then the result to alcohol and the result to crime and the result to all this, things. So really, we need to strike a balance now. Yes, I understand that back then it was really necessary to bring in the girl child and bring up everything to include her and to support her. But I think we've come to a point now where we need to find an equilibrium, you know. We really need to find a balance, supporting the boy child and supporting the girl child. Nonetheless, of course, this is On The Radar News Analysis. Let's pause right here. But we'll be back to give you good news about today's lucky winner of the 500 ShopRite YouSave gift voucher. Please do stay on the line. You never know. You might be that very lucky winner. Don't go anywhere.
Lipurane ngene wapogwa Eva tere ulikoni mando tete ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala onongeshe faa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nene udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijabweli nawa ninge Monica Co. Eagle FM, Honora is that you may be here.
A very good afternoon. How are you? Why do you sound so sad? Why do you sound so sad? Okay, I can hear you so well. I'm just in. Just speak a little bit up for me, okay? This is Happy calling you from Eagle FM. You are live on radio right now. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you in bed? I know it's cold. Okay. Do you mind sitting up? Yeah. Just sit up and give me that vibrant feedback in your voice.
All right.
Who am I speaking to?
You're speaking to Frida.
Frida, what's your surname?
Amadila.
Frida Amadila, where are you right now? Which part of Namibia Bendi. Are you? Ooh, the capital city, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, the city of lights. Frida, I'm here to make your day. You are today's lucky winner of the 500 ShopRite YouSave gift voucher.
Serious?
Oh, yes. Very serious. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How do you intend on spending your gift voucher?
Mm-hmm.
How do you intend on spending your gift voucher?
I'm going to buy my food.
You're going to?
To buy my food.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. That's nice. You know what? We're happy to make your day. Congratulations. Congratulations. My colleague will definitely call you up and let you know how you can pick up your gift voucher. Congratulations again.
Well, thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Have yourself a great day.
Bye, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. And then we had it from Friday's lucky winner of the 500 gift voucher. I tell you, stay on the line, keep on participating. You might just be the lucky winner of this gift voucher. Now, remember, this competition is ongoing for a very long time. Started off last year, and we are definitely going up until the end of the year. So please do be on the watch, on the lookout. You might just be the lucky winner. With that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. I told you, this is On The Radio News Analysis. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the only person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any...
E filoshisho, otali kulandula kona ave wayuka. E kwashili pale kolo maruendo paiwano kupitila mo NHP. O atuka teleko meshwe kwashili pale kolo afika mafio pe dola emiliona omlongo danamibia. Moshi joshe tukeshe kuyanja oma kwa fo unamiti enashane filoshisho lopa ulumo mumbu. Kwa avoveli ponje yoshilongo, shijoshi topor washo ijo yetu, tashiningwa inapawe banando ishoshe layash. Opo umone ya kulolo polis mwule ominute disyonailela, lishangifako nhp.com.na omanga ino ya moruendo. Ponjeo Shilong. E mangono malandula fano o dodino kulandurwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
Anywhere, countrywide, to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi to danjuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi tayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamwili nawa. Ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kumberewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back. And of course, at this juncture, we take you for news beyond the borders of Namibia. Right. Let's start off with some sad news. Former president of Botswana, Festus Mwage, passed on at the age of 86.
Former Botswanian President Festus Mogae has passed away. He was the third president of Botswana after taking over from Sir Kitumile Masire from a couple of years back. Let's get you more on the story with our specialist correspondent, Sophie Mukwena, who's with us here. And there's so much more to be said, Sophie, but perhaps let's begin with that address from the current president of the country, Induma Boko, who's just paid tribute to his predecessor. What did he say?
Well, he indicated the role played by former President Festus Mogae in terms of cementing democracy in Botswana. As you know, that since democratic dispensation in Botswana, Botswana has been a very stable democracy. Yes, after President Khama, the founding father of Botswana, and then followed by Kitumile Masire to Festus Mogae, to Khama, Ian Khama, to Mokgweetsi Masisi, and now to Duma Boko, the transfer of power has been very smooth. And therefore, he also contributed in terms of ensuring that transfer of power in Botswana is very smooth and cementing the democracy in that country, building Botswana, but also presiding over a country at a very challenging moment during his leadership economically and as it relates to health issues. And therefore, he was crediting President Festus Mogae with sterling leadership.
And it's no surprise then that as the tributes continue streaming in from all over the continent, he's really being remembered as this beacon of good governance because of those principles that saw him through, as you mentioned, a really difficult time in the country.
Yes, because he was very committed to democracy. And on the issue of difficult times, you know that any country, there's time where you go through challenges of the economy. So he had to ensure that Botswana does find a path to ensure that it has got a sustainable economic growth. And focusing on one sector, that is mining, the diamonds, was not going to make Botswana competitive, but also sustainable. And therefore, he had to look at how do you ensure that you change the economic policy and the trajectory of Botswana. And it was a challenging moment. Then come the challenge of HIV and AIDS. You know that many countries were affected in the sub-Sahara country, and Botswana was also in serious crisis. He was able to come up with a program to ensure that he is able to manage that situation. When people were thinking that it is the end of Botswana because the pandemic was ravaging the southern part of the region, including South Africa, and Botswana being a small country with a small population. So you have the economic challenges where you have to adapt and change the economic policy. On the other hand, you have to deal with the pandemic. But also, on the continent, he was very vocal about the situation in Zimbabwe. Mm. He took President Robert Mugabe head on, criticizing him about the violence in that country during elections. And many African leaders were not happy with that. But that was Festus Mogae. He believed in democracy. He didn't shy away calling out his peers where there was a need to do so.
Yeah, and as you say that, in fact, I see a tribute that's also come through from Hopewell Chingono, a prominent Zimbabwean journalist who's described Mogae as one of the very few respected leaders on the continent. And I suppose it's off the back of what you're saying about his ability to speak out amid a time where, let's face it, on the continent, sometimes the criticism is that the leaders of these countries are part of a boys' club, essentially, where they don't call each other out at moments where, in fact, you need to do that.
Yes, that's true. And also his contribution on the continent. At some point in time, he was an envoy on the South Sudan question. You know that that country, yeah, the newest nation, has never been really at full capacity of peace. At times it's quiet, but there's always challenges with this new state. And at some point in time, he was an envoy of the UN on trying to ensure that there's peace in South Sudan and there's strong democracy and institutions of democracy in South Sudan do hold, much as South Africa was assisting with resources and skills. And therefore, he has done a lot. It's not only about Botswana.
Yeah.
It's about the region. It's about the continent. But secondly, in his retirement, he worked on ensuring that the issue of HIV and AIDS, as it relates to treatment and prevention, continue to be at the center. It's not forgotten. And therefore, he was chairing a very important committee that deals with that as it relates to pharmaceutical companies. And when he retired 6 years ago, he handed over that responsibility to the former South African president, Kgalema Motlanthe, who had to continue with that work of ensuring that we do have vaccines,
yeah.
We do continue to remember that HIV and AIDS is still a challenge.
Speaking of former President Kgalema Motlanthe, these two gentlemen join a long list of heads of states that you've actually sat down with. And I wonder if we can speak about President Mokgaya as a person. As you sat across him, what comes to mind now as we take stock of his legacy?
Yes, 6 years ago when he was handing over this work of pharmaceutical companies working hard to ensure that we continue to have treatment.
Meanwhile, the South African government orders more vaccines in order to contain the foot and mouth disease.
From there, I want to take you to this now. KwaZulu-Natal's entire dairy herd has now been vaccinated against foot and mouth disease. The province's state veterinarian, Dr. Themba Skakane, made the announcement at the Sidara in the Midlands earlier in the week. The province produces 30% of the country's raw milk, while the minister in the presidency, Khumbudzo Ntshavheni, today announced that cabinet had ordered additional doses of foot and mouth disease. Agriculture Minister John Senezon joins us now for more on this and how to contain the worst of the outbreak. Minister, good evening. Thank you so much for your time. Really do appreciate it. Perhaps to ask you a starting point question. I mean, we're well into the undertaking of these efforts, but I think it remains an important question nonetheless, because it's one you'll have to answer in court recently. What is the logic behind the state's monopolistic approach to foot and mouth disease vaccinations?
The state doesn't have a monopolistic approach to foot and mouth disease at all. In fact, the entire process involves the private sector, from the distribution of vaccines to the import and sale of vaccines. All of these involve the private sector. The monopolistic notion is a fiction designed by those who are unhappy with the fact that all international examples and all international literature shows that the state has to remain in overall control of the foot and mouth disease crisis, and because it is only the state that can apply to the World Organization of Animal Health to change our status from an FMD country to an FMD-free country with vaccination that will allow us to open up our markets that have been closed for 20 years in order for us to be able to sell red meat products. The private sector is involved in the distribution of vaccines, in the usage of vaccines, as well as the importation of vaccines. So that is a fiction, I'm afraid, of those who are constantly trying to criticize rather than focus on the efforts to beat the disease.
Yeah, the exclusive terrain of the state being able to make the application to the World Health Organization to change the declaration of the country from a foot-and-mouth disease-ridden country to a foot-and-mouth disease-free country has got no bearing on how the management of that takes place. And you mentioned that the international best practice is for the state to control the administration thereof. But three organizations, the South Africa Agriculture Initiative, SAKALIGA, as well as Free State Agriculture, are making the argument that farmers should be able to procure vaccines themselves directly and not wait on the state.
Well, the problem is that these vaccines are controlled substances. They are also imported under an emergency Section 21 application. And you may recall the last time that was done was with COVID vaccines. And you may recall that you could not walk into a pharmacy, purchase COVID vaccines, and vaccinate your children at home. The same applies here. These are not registered medicines in South Africa, and therefore there does have to be a measure of control. It also shows very clearly in what we're doing that private veterinarians and private animal health technicians are actively involved in the vaccination process. You can't have a vaccine free for all. I've just returned from Argentina and Brazil, where we studied very closely the model that they used there, and they used exactly the same model of collaboration with the private sector, but with the state having overall administrative control over the area. So it absolutely has a bearing on how the program is rolled out, because these are not registered medicines in South Africa. They're not registered for use here. And the example that allowing farmers to vaccinate their animals on themselves will solve all the problems is belied by the fact that brucellosis and brucellosis vaccines are registered here in South Africa, and farmers can vaccinate their own animals, and yet we still have outbreaks of brucellosis because those vaccinations are not done. So it is essential that provincial veterinary services and national veterinary services remain in overall control over this. But we're doing so in partnership with industry bodies, with private veterinarians, and private procurers of vaccines to be able to ensure we are vaccinating at scale.
Yeah. Just last week, Minister, the Gauteng North High Court chastised you for having missed the deadline to submit your Section 10 vaccination scheme, which is an important piece in the puzzle towards solving South Africa's foot and mouth disease crisis. You had missed the deadline seemingly multiple times. So why has that been the case? So much so that the court slapped you with punitive costs.
That's not the case. We had to advertise the scheme. I cannot, as the Minister of Agriculture, just publish a scheme without going through a public consultation process, because no doubt had we done that, those involved in this litigation would have instituted another case saying that there was no public participation. We advertised the scheme on the 10th in the Gazette. We gave 7 days for comments that closed on the 17th, and we published that scheme on Monday. Now, I would much rather err on the side of ensuring we have full public consultation, and we received over 360 public comments on that, including comments from the applicants in the court case. And it was essential that when government does these processes, that there is public consultation. We've met the court's deadline. We're in court again on Monday, and I'm very confident that the judge will affirm the fact that the state has to play the central role in terms of the rollout of this particular process, of course.
And now, more regional news. Let's speak about the CRG which replaces Tanzania's old meter gauge system.
Tanzania operates East Africa's first electrified standard gauge railway, a project aimed at transforming how people and goods move across the country. Two of the six planned phases are complete. The government says it has now secured funding for most of the remaining sections.
Funding for phases 3 and 4 is in place, and phase 5 has also secured funding. Implementation now depends on contractor progress. The funds are ready.
With speeds of up to 160 kilometers per hour and fares averaging around $15 between Dar es Salaam and the capital Dodoma, the railway is increasingly drawing new passengers.
Fuel prices have affected our economy, so now you can take the train instead of driving. It makes things much easier.
It saves a lot of time. My bus takes about 8 hours, but with the SGR it's about 4 to 5 hours. It's very convenient. We really enjoy it.
As of April 2026, Tanzania has invested more than $10 billion in the railway, which upon completion will span just over 2,500 kilometers in total. Authorities say a recent $2.3 billion financing deal will support upcoming phases, while regional development partners are expected to back additional sections, with China Civil Engineering Construction Corporation handling parts of the construction. For the past 21 months, Tanzania Standard Gauge Railway has carried more than 5.5 million passengers between Dar es Salaam and the capital Dodoma, about 9,000 people each day. While that's still small compared to the tens of millions traveling by road annually, the SGR's speed and reliability are steadily shifting commuter preferences. After years of funding challenges, the project is now gaining momentum. But economists warn that rising revenues must eventually balance the cost of borrowing.
Only financing is not an issue, but how are they going to refund the money and repay the loans? Because we still have a lot of other issues to deal with when it comes to health sectors, education sectors, and other sectors such as agriculture and the rest.
With a projected freight capacity of up to 10,000 tons, the government aims to increase the rail's share of cargo from just 2% to 30% by 2030, easing pressure on roads and improving efficiency at the port of Dar es Salaam. Officials say the railway will play a key role in boosting regional trade, aligning with Africa's broad ambitions to improve connectivity and reduce transport costs. Isaac Lukando, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
Health officials from multiple countries, including the UK, are scrambling to trace passengers who left a cruise liner before the deadly Hunter virus outbreak was confirmed. Singapore is now isolating and testing two people who were on the ship. Hunter virus typically spreads from rodents, but it's thought that in this case, it may have passed between humans that were in close contact. About 150 people are still on board the liner. The MV Hundius left Argentina on the 1st of April. 10 days later, on the 11th of April, the first passenger died, a Dutch man who is suspected to have had the virus. The cruise ship continued on to the remote South Atlantic island of St. Helena, where the wife of that man disembarked with his body. She then travelled to South Africa, where she later died. And we now know that 30 passengers in total left the ship, who also disembarked in St. Helena. Seven are British, six are from the US, three from the Netherlands, two from Canada, Switzerland and Turkey, and one case each from Germany, Denmark, New Zealand, Singapore, Sweden and the Caribbean island of St. Kitts and Nevis. We already know about two British people as well who are self-isolating at home and flew back to the UK. Now, neither had symptoms, but contacted authorities when they heard about the ship's cases. And the cruise ship has then continued its trip, dropping anchor off the coast of Cape Verde on the 3rd of May. We can show you the current position of the liner. The remaining passengers and crew are now sailing to the Canary Islands, where they could be allowed to disembark on Saturday if they don't appear to have symptoms. Guy Hitchcock is our correspondent in the Canaries and Tenerife, and he says it's still unclear as to how and where some passengers will be quarantined once they reach the islands.
Well, it's still unclear exactly when the ship will arrive. We're told it would take 3 to 4 days. It could be either Saturday or possibly Sunday, according to some reports. So that's still unclear. I think it might depend a bit on the weather during the journey. But we do know that there are members of staff from the World Health Organization on board, along with infectious disease experts, who are carrying out assessments of the passengers as they travel. When they do arrive here at the weekend, they will be assessed again. And we're told that there will be no contact between the passengers from the boat and local people here. They will be assessed and then a decision will be made in terms of whether they can be immediately repatriated to their countries. Remember, these are passengers from 23 different countries on board the ship, or whether they have to stay and undergo some kind of treatment. There are 14 Spaniards on board. We're told that they will be taken to a hospital in Madrid. There's some slightly confusing information in terms of how they will be handled, because one ministry's talked about them undergoing a voluntary quarantine. Another ministry said it would be an obligatory quarantine for those Spaniards when they arrive. But I think we'll hear more about the details in terms of exactly how this situation will be handled nearer the time, either on Saturday or Sunday.
Thomas Hoffman is the head of emergency preparedness and response at the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, joining us now from Stockholm. Thomas, very good to have you with us. We are told that this is a rare event, but that the risk to the public is low, even negligible. So I wonder at the moment, what are your concerns?
Yeah, our concerns are mainly right now to really get procedures in place for the safe disembarkation of the passengers. We're working intensively now with the affected member states, with partners, with the World Health Organization to set up procedures which are suitable for this situation.
Is there an issue around the long incubation period of this virus? Does that complicate, surely it does, all of the tracing, contact tracing that's taking place?
Surely it does, although there's still, we know from science that in most cases, incubation period still is around 3 weeks. So, of course, I think anyone needs to stay vigilant afterwards. But I think we still have the majority of cases having a clearly defined incubation period.
But is there a concern that this can be spread, that there can be an airborne spread of this?
No, this strain of Hunter virus cannot spread airborne. I mean, it's not a respiratory disease like we know COVID or influenza. Also, it can, I mean, it's very rare at all that it transmits from human to human. Hunter virus normally only transmits from rodent, infected rodents to humans. But in this situation, yes, human to human transmission occurred. As people had close contacts on sailing 5 weeks on a cruise ship.
Thomas, we're seeing pictures of some people being taken off the ship, and everyone there is wearing what looks like some kind of Hamza suit or you know, protective gear. What is it that needs to happen to make sure that those people are safe? What are the measures that are taking place?
What we recommend in our risk assessment, which we published yesterday, is that people should wear masks, regular face masks, and of course, in clinical care, people should consider wearing FFP2 masks. But as said, it's really like not a respiratory disease, which does transmit so easily. So regular precautions are sufficient and recommended at this point in time.
And just a final message from you, Thomas, to the public, to those that are watching and listening at the moment, about the risk to the general public at the moment.
Yeah, the risk to the general public is very low, as we stated also in our risk assessment. And it's again because, first of all, the rodent is not present in Europe, where the Hunter virus usually gets infected or transmitted to humans, then human-to-human transmission only occurs under very close contact.
Meanwhile, still on this Hunter virus outbreak, countries trace cruise passengers after this Hunter virus.
Several countries are trying to trace passengers who left the cruise ship before a Hunter virus outbreak was confirmed. Dutch authorities say around 40 people got off the vessel on the island of St. Helena 2 weeks ago, and there are now 8 known or suspected hantavirus cases linked to the ship, with 3 people dead. Singapore has become the latest country to say it's testing 2 former passengers. The ship is now heading to the Canary Islands under a Spanish plan to allow passengers to disembark, despite opposition from locals there.
A WHO expert boarded the ship in Cabo Verde and has been joined by 2 doctors from the Netherlands and an expert from the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, who will stay on the ship until it reaches the Canary Islands. They're conducting a medical assessment of everyone on board and gathering information to assess their risk of infection. WHO is developing step-by-step operational guidance for the safe and respectful disembarkation and onward travel of passengers and crew when they arrive.
We're getting reports of suspect cases or potential suspect cases. These are alerts, as we call them. Some of them have had reported links to the ship or passengers on the ship. All of those will be followed up with the relevant authorities in each country. This is not coronavirus. This is a very different virus We know this virus, hantaviruses have been around for quite a while. There's a lot of detail that we know.
Well, the World Health Organization is now calling for increased investment in Africa's health security following reported hantavirus cases aboard a ship traveling from South America to West Africa. Speaking in Ghana's capital, Accra, the WHO Regional Director for Africa, Mohamed Janabi, said the incident highlights the importance of stronger health systems and global cooperation in responding to emerging health threats.
Let us commit to three priorities. Plan better, by protecting training investments, train smarter using scalable and practical approaches, and retain our talent through clear career pathways and supportive working environments. If we get it, we get this right, we are not only responding to hantavirus, we are strengthening Africa health security for every threat ahead.
Staying with health matters, a wave of health misinformation in the DRC has turned deadly. False rumors spread online and amplified by local influencers and churches have fueled mob violence, leading to the killing of at least 17 people, including health workers conducting vaccination research. And as CGTN's Sharon Baranga reports, one widow is still searching for answers after her husband was burned alive.
In the streets of Kisangani, life is moving on. But for many families in this part of northeastern DRC, fear and grief remain after a deadly misinformation campaign spread through villages and social media. Authorities say false claims about a mysterious disease causing genital atrophy triggered panic late last year. Within days, rumors exploded online, eventually leading to mob attacks on health workers. Among those killed was Dr. John Tangakea.
I had just spoken to my husband and he had asked us to wish him a happy birthday, which we did. But right after, we tried to call him back without success. I wondered what was happening. He never came back. We only learned the news of his death. Today, I am deeply upset.
Tangakea was part of a vaccination research team attacked in Shopo province in October. Witnesses and officials say villagers accused the group of spreading the fake illness. Four health workers were killed. His widow says the attackers burned him alive.
To this day, I have never understood why they decided to kill my husband. They burned him alive without even leaving me a trace of him. This is what makes us suffer the most. We asked his employer to take us to the place where he was burned, but our request remained unanswered.
The Africa Infodemic Response Alliance says the rumors spread rapidly through Facebook, TikTok, churches, and local media. The World Health Organization-backed group runs a hotline receiving thousands of calls each week about rumors, fears, and vaccine misinformation. Distrust of vaccines and medical workers has grown across parts of Africa, fueled by social media and weak healthcare systems.
When I say misinformation is killing, it's true. And we know, we have so many examples of what you are giving and so many others. And we saw even health workers being killed for a vaccination, polio vaccination campaign.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Reader News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengue program brought to you by Benyambeko Jonas. Goodbye.